This episode of Dollars and Cents is brought to you by AT&T Puerto Rico, Banco Popular de Puerto Rico, Liberty Puerto Rico, and Walmart Puerto Rico.
Hey everyone, this is Michelle Cantro Vasquez, and I am the founder and editor of News Is My Business, an online news site based in San Juan, Puerto Rico, about the island's business community. In this episode of Dollars and Cents, we'll be discussing the economy as it pertains to both individuals and the business sector. With us today are two well-respected economists, Jose Joaquin Villamil, founder of the Estudios Técnicos Inc. analyst firm, and Antonio Fernos, economy professor at the Inter-American University and vice chairman of the Puerto Rico Institute of Statistics. Thank you both for being here today. The economy is often seen as a heavy subject to discuss, but there really is no way around the fact that we've all been affected by the events of the past year or so after Hurricane Maria. So let's dive right in. What's the current scenario for consumers as we head into the holiday season? Is there more money flowing that could translate into better retail activity through the end of the year? Villamil, your firm recently worked with the entrepreneurs on a study discussing the status of the local business community post-storm. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Obviously, the federal funds that have come in mostly beginning in January, add up to maybe $7 or $8 billion, and they go directly to consumption. And that explains why, for example, if you look at the statistics, you'll see that retail sales have increased. Sales of automobiles are increasing at a rate that no one expected. So basically, I think what we're looking at is a temporary peak in the consumption behavior of Puerto Ricans. And that's why I think what William Dudley said when he was in Puerto Rico, the former president of the Fed, of the New York Fed, he said, don't be seduced by temporary reconstruction dollars. And I think we are being seduced by thinking that things are going very well and that we're the economy is recovering and so forth. It is to some extent, but mostly it'll be a temporary phenomenon while the federal funds continue to flow.
Okay. I agree. Basically, it is yet to be seen whether money supply will still be in shortage in the next, I guess, medium term. In the short term, you will see flow of funds in an extraordinary non-trend setting scenario. Mm-hmm. That's why you have all this consumption going on, but you really have to measure, as I said, whether it's trend setting or not. And of course, we already know this is going to be a short-lived lifeline that first and foremost, we should see if the mapping of the funds are going whether to final consumption or at some point whether it's going to investment side. As many of the installed capacity was hurt, we need most of this money to reconstruct in order to get our installed capacity ready to produce. You cannot expect more consumption level or this level of consumption if you don't get all this investment going on and get the ball rolling. Of course, consumption is the ulterior motive of production, but if it's a short-lived flow of consumption, almost everything is must come to an end at some point.
And that said, today the Fiscal Oversight Board approved a fiscal plan for the government that, among many other things, says that fiscal 2019 will see an increase in economic activity of 7.8%. Is that something that makes sense? Is that right? And why or why not?
Well, we've been very skeptical of using GNP, real GNP growth, to measure whether the economy is recovering or not, because of the nature of the beast, because of the way it's put together. And so we prefer to use specific indicators, employment and so on. And one of the things that is of some concern is the fact that if you look at total employment, it has gone up. But if you look at salaried employment, it has gone down. And what that tells me is that many of the jobs that are included in total employment are temporary jobs. They're contract workers. They're not salaried employees. What that suggests is what Antonio just said a little earlier, that this may very well be a temporary, not trend-setting type of behavior. But in any case, to estimate GNP at 7.8 or something is what seems to me to be a little exaggerated on the optimistic side. But on the other hand, their estimate that GNP, real GNP in 2018, fiscal 2018, fell by 8% seems to be overly pessimistic. We, in our firm, we believe that growth in 2018 was zero or a little bit above or a little bit below zero, but certainly not something as drastic as minus 8%.
I agree. First and foremost, at this particular moment, you have to be very skeptical or maybe proceed with abundance of caution in terms of what economic indicators you're using in order to measure the mapping of these funds and how are they mapped into the supply chain of production. We have, for the last 20 years, a damaged economic panel of instruments. So economics is known as the dismal science. And we're becoming, in Puerto Rico, even more dismal than in the past 20 years. So our crystal ball was damaged. Now it's broken. So you basically have zero visibility in the short term, since you don't have clear instruments, and whatever instruments you have in place, they haven't been calibrated to measure the economic activity. So you have to proceed with abundance of caution in terms of what are the multiplier effects when you're mapping all this flow of funds that are short-lived. And since we know for a fact that all these temporary flow of funds had, on the downside, created a temporary price increase in most of staples, and creating what Villamil just mentioned, a temporary decrease on unemployment rate that goes along with a temporary short-lived increase on labor participation rates. But when you're looking at real prices, you're going to see that people are effectively earning less, but more people are working. At the end of the road, you really have to measure. I mean, economists like to, and I'm getting a little bit more technical here, on elasticity of labor supply. So are we getting the jobs that we really need, and at what real prices are we setting them? And everything is just blurry, but everything seems to point that, again, this is short-lived, no trend setting, and at some point, this is going to be a matter of how resilient the economy is going to get once this federal flow of funds exit.
So celebrating, you know, the 8%, I don't know what the unemployment rate is at. It's celebrating that. Is that something?
It's on single digits, but I don't think it's between something. Nine. I think it was 9.7 on August.
So is it fair to
I mean, it's considerably lower. We've been on double digit unemployment rate since, wow, everything.
For years.
Wow, one of the things that has happened.
Since I was in college.
That the people who've migrated tend to be in those years in which participation rates tend to be fairly low. The 41% of those who leave the island are below the age of 24, 25.
So that's the working group.
So, you know, you can't look at those indicators in an isolated manner. You have to place them in the context of what's going on in the demographics of the country, too.
Now, you mentioned multiplier effects.
Well, the thing is, it doesn't, you have different, you have to peel the onion a little bit. So that being said is, whenever you put $1 in one industry that is labor intensive, will create more jobs than if you put $1 on sectors that are capital intensive. It doesn't, that meaning you will create something, but I guess it determines whether you go into the manufacturing section of the economy, which is more capital intensive, or if you put more money into the retail slash services sector, which is more labor intensive. On the labor intensive side, you tend to have lower real wages. On the capital intensive side, wages are way higher. You have good earners of salaries, benefits, including, you know, exit packages and the like. That's how the economy works. So I guess it's a matter of whether it's a public policy regarding which are groups are you going to be addressing once you revamp, if revamping, we achieve those levels of economic activity, since you need to determine which sector is going to be the triggering at the end of the road, the production needed. Building a service economy at the end of the line, it doesn't work, because you need to give services to the producing engine of the economy. If you have no production, who are you going to be servicing to?
Right.
So that being said, you really have to be working with the demographics, specifically what's going on into the assembly line or to the pipeline. At this particular moment, since I'm a college professor, I've seen only 8% of the population, it's basically college students. This is the age group between 19 to 25. These are yet people to get into the labor force, or maybe they are in the labor force, but they're starting. They tend to have the lowest of the wages. So with 8% of the entire population holding the spinal cord of the entire 3.6 people Puerto Rican island, their chances of holding the entire economy are next to dismal.
Okay, so that said, can we talk a little bit about the effects of migration? I mean, it's been talked about over and over, but can we maybe get, you know, some sort of sense of how that's playing out now and how it can drive Puerto Rico in the next year, two or three?
More like in the next 5 or 10 or 15 years.
Okay.
No, I think migration is a big item. And as I said a little earlier, the composition of migration makes a great deal of difference. People have focused on the demand side implications of the loss of population. I mean, less demand for housing, less demand for this, less demand for that. But there's also a supply side impact, which is very important, which people tend to leave out of the equation. And I refer to that basically the fact that we are losing a number of not only medical doctors or specialists or subspecialists, but trained nurses, trained teachers, trained policemen, trained firemen, trained construction workers. And so basically what migration is doing at this point is weakening the human capital reserve of the island. And that is a huge problem going forward. The other thing which people tend to overlook is the fact that when we lost around 25% of the population 60 years ago, that was quickly made up because our birth rate was very high. But since 2015, the birth rate is, the number of births now is below the number of deaths. So we have that contributing to the population.
So the island is draining.
The island is draining, and basically our population is not only smaller, but it'll be much older. And when you talk about an older population in Puerto Rico, you're talking basically about a low-income population.
Now,
what that does...
So what do you do to bring these people back?
Well, you create jobs, you get the economy moving, you get it into the fiscal board's head that they have to deal with economic growth, not just fiscal austerity. And you start basically taking steps to generate well-paying jobs. And I think the best example that I can mention is the aerospace industry. The University of Puerto Rico in Mayagüez used to lose half of its graduates, used to migrate. But since we have that aerospace industry there, good-paying jobs, that has lowered immensely. I mean, it's become a machine for generating jobs for engineers. And so that gives you an idea that that's what we need to do. But one of the things that we need to do is that we should have a much more clear policy on how to deal with the Puerto Rican population in the United States, which we haven't had ever.
Mm-hmm. Now, you spoke of statistics. That's up your alley.
I mean, extending it a little bit more, expanding the thing. Puerto Rico has never planned for a service economy. And if you're going to do that, then you should be able to aim that those services go to the elderly group because of the demographics involved. So if the majority of Puerto Ricans are going to be, you know, belonging to 65 years or more, try that production goes in, of course, production in itself, but on services aimed to be used by the elderly population. And if you need to subsidize those, well, you know, it is what it is. You should be doing so. You should be taking into consideration the supply chain in order to get your assembly line, in order to address, first and foremost, housing. Okay, yes, we need housing, but we need more housing for the elderly and for the poor elderly.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of services, what are the services that are in need within the elderly community? You know, what for food, clothes, medicine, health-related issues, recreational spaces for not only for the elderly that, you know, can achieve, they have a high sense of mobility, but on the other side that are, you know, they cannot depend on themselves in terms of mobility. They you don't want an elderly group being, you know, the huge chunk of the island that are depressed because they have no one to talk to. You mm-hmm. have no recreation mm-hmm. whatsoever.
But that needs to happen yesterday. I mean, the elderly community is now. It's not in the future.
And it's not looking. The thing is, an additional challenge is that, of course, fertility rates are going down. You know, birthday rates are going down. But who starts on the net migration, the trigger on the net migration is on the male population. And if females and their siblings and their sons and daughters are staying here, but, you know, now this is 2-1 in terms of, you know, 2 females every 1 female in terms of fertility, you know, birthdays, and whoever is staying, we need both. If not, then women will, you know, certain incentives need to be addressed for who is going to be heading, who's going to be head of household, who's going to be working, who's going to be attending children. You need to start then looking for public education to extend, you know, instead of going out at noon or get another block until children can stay in at 6 o'clock in order for the mothers to
work,
the entire, you know, full time.
Right.
So you need to redirect. You need to reshuffle your strategies in order to map it on where it's needed into the next couple of years.
And that's where the statistics, you know, having clear statistics
Which we don't.
Vital.
I mean, we need to fix the economic panel of instruments because you have almost zero visibility on most of this stuff. Federal government, as you know, they're being hesitant on going full throttle on the set of statistics that they could get out of the Puerto Rican, you know, economy. They don't use the entire menu of services, quote unquote, that they the role they play on the other 50 states. So we don't have the full set of statistics that we should be able to have. I mean, they're short of funding. That's a, you know, U.S. Congress issue. But, you know, it might become key once you start doing public policy and on what plan to execute.
So, you know, what can Puerto Rico expect in coming months and years? I mean, is there anything positive out there to look forward to, or are we going to be in this funk for a while?
Both.
Both. Okay, so.
A little bit of both. I guess it's a matter of what's the lag in terms of how fast can this external, you know, federal funds not only arrive on how the, because these funds will arrive and they're going to be placed at certain public institutions, you know, government institutions, and they need to get over all the hurdles necessary with full compliance with the federal government. And it takes a while to put, you know, to follow everything in terms of permits and who's going to be and the money to flow to eventually to the ulterior motive, that it's whether, you know, how much is going to take to build whatever necessary housing or building the roads or fixing whatever needs to be fixed from project A to B, and what stages, and in terms of percentage of completion within the next couple of, I don't know, between 18 to 36 months.
Okay.
Two things that I think one should mention, building on what Antonio just said. One is that people are focused on reconstructing from the hurricane. But the fact is that this economy has been contracting for 12 years or 14 years, even longer than that, really. And that long-term contraction and very deep contraction had very similar effects to the hurricane. It didn't blow roofs off houses, but it did weaken the labor market. It did weaken the things that Antonio had been talking about. It did weaken substantially the infrastructure. Basically, when the hurricane hit, part of the problem was that we had stopped maintenance and reserves and that sort of stuff for years. So we need to rebuild, not just from the hurricane, we need to rebuild from a very long and very deep economic contraction. That, together with the fact that, as was mentioned a little earlier by Antonio, the demographics will mean that we will have to create a whole new set of institutions to deal with that population. And it will have an impact on every single market. It'll have an impact on the housing market. It'll have an impact on the educational market, on the labor markets, so forth and so on. And housing, for example, one of the things that one points out all the time is that as the population grows older, what is known as the rate of household formation falls significantly. To give you an idea, between 1970 and 2000, the rate of new household formations in Puerto Rico was 20,000, 21,000. Between 2000 and 2010, it fell to 11,000. This decade, the estimate is around 2,300. Okay? So what that tells you is that the housing construction industry will not experience a great need for new housing. So you have to look at other things. What are they going to do? Well, they're going to build housing for the elderly, or they're going to build housing to make up for what the hurricane destroyed. So, you know, it's a very difficult situation because it's not just physical reconstruction from the hurricane, the Build Back Better stuff, that sort of thing. It's really reconstructing an economy that had already been considerably weakened for a long time.
So what's the positive?
Well, the positive, I think, is we have the opportunity if we know how to do it. But I think what is lacking, I don't know if Antonio would agree with that, is that we don't really have a plan. We don't really have a vision of where we want to be 5 or 10 or 15 years from now, and what do we need to do to get there. And I think we must embark on a sort of a reverse engineering process. Where do we want to be 10 years from now, and what do we have to do to get there? And I mentioned the other day to someone, you know, we should be looking at 2030. I said, oh, well, that's a long ways off. And he said, no, it's not a long ways off. It's 12 years away. Right. But we don't know that. We don't know. The fiscal board basically is operating in a vacuum in that sense. And they don't really know what their actions are going to lead to. They have some assumptions that they're making that this will work or that will work, but not really. And I think more than anything else, we need to have a consensus on where we as a society want to be in 10, 15 years.
I agree. This is, you know, first and foremost, we need to reconvene the social contract. Mm-hmm. after, and that's no easy task. And it's not done in the short term. It takes a while. Second, you need to establish what are the trends that you need to reverse. So in terms of, you know, every single economic growth model will take into consideration population growth, not population decline. It's just unsustainable. You cannot execute something when the demographics are just exiting and there's nothing entering the equation. We need to diversify everything from the supply side, from the demand side, and we need to reconfigure how the foreign direct investment is going to work. How is it going to be mapped into the real economy? How the money markets work, how the goods and services markets work, and geared, or I guess it is aspirationally speaking, what kind of population or what kind of country we shall have in order to get a roadmap and to achieve a more equitable and definitely more sustainable economy and hence society.
And this is something that has to be worked out with participation both from the government and the private sector. And it just so happens that a couple of weeks ago I was sitting in a press conference where the head of the Puerto Rico's largest bank was saying that it is less often than not that the private sector is asked for an opinion about what's going to be happening or the decisions that are going to be made. Instead, they just get a call saying, okay, this is what's going to happen. Agree with me.
You know, the funny thing is that's true. That same guy basically is the one funding the government, and they, in as much, are kind of so big. They're too big to bail bank within. You know, so it's a... They too are included into the moral hazard model of the Puerto Rico public administration and institutions. And we will basically, or at least I had the expectation in terms of them upping up the ante. So saying, you know what? We need more participation from the private sector since the government is bankrupt. But the thing is, they don't have the capital to put in. Private sector had, you know, their years of excess capital formation, and they, you know, most of these people have no longer the necessary capital to put in. So Puerto Rico shifted within the last 25 years into a form of capitalism without capital. Next thing we need to have is, in order to have a capitalism or a capitalist economy, you need capital. Mm-hmm. And Puerto Rico has no capital.
Well, yeah, I remember years ago, I invited to Puerto Rico a friend who had been treasury minister in Mexico. My name is Jesus Silva Herzog. And Jesus gave a speech in Puerto Rico, and he said in Mexico, they had realized that they had to privatize the private sector. And that applies so much to Puerto Rico. And the reason why I said that is that the government has such a large footprint on the economy that just about every private organization has some link with the government in some way or another. And so they're very, shy.
Well, they don't want to lose their lifelines.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They're very shy about intervening in policy issues. Right now, for example, there's a tax reform bill in the legislature. I would have expected the private sector organizations to be jumping right into the debate. Say, no, you know, the type of tax system we need is this, that, and the other thing. And that hasn't happened.
Well, they're fighting about the inventory tax.
That's a one thing. Mm-hmm. But that's Walmart, basically, who's pushing that. Everybody wants it. In fact, I suggested that we get rid of the inventory tax years ago because it's a bad tax. But right now, that campaign is basically what's the name of the organization? Retail Sales Organization, which is Walmart and Walgreens. Obviously, it makes a huge difference. You eliminate the inventory tax, it'll mean $30 or $40 million a year for these big firms.
But isn't it also favorable for consumers? I mean, we did see empty shelves after the hurricane. That was scary.
It is. It's a bad tax. It's a bad, no one would question that. Okay. But that's a very minor part of what the tax reform
is. It's the most vocal part of the reform.
It's vocal because it touches specific interests. But it's still a minor part of the tax
system. So what else should be out there?
Oh, all kinds of things. For example, in 2011, Law 1, mm-hmm. remember that? That we were all very happy because our tax rates went down and so on, but it created a huge fiscal mess. But the worst part about Law 1 was that it did nothing to stimulate investment. What it did do was stimulate consumption. And in an economy in which such a large share of material consumption is imported, that doesn't do anything for the economy. It does a great deal for Taiwan and Hong Kong and China and so forth, but you don't do a tax reform to stimulate consumption, particularly in the context of Puerto Rico, where
which is already a consumption economy.
Exactly. Not only that, but in which investment has fallen so significantly.
So, you know, let's wrap this up perhaps by giving some sort of let's use a crystal ball, why don't we? and maybe predict, again, maybe 5-10 years down the road, what Puerto Rico will look like or should look like. Pull out your crystal ball.
I remember a very famous quote from
an
economist who said, "Those who live by the crystal ball must learn to eat shredded glass."
Okay.
No, I think basically we should, rather than thinking of where we will be, I think we should be thinking of where we want to be. And that's what we haven't done.
And how to get there.
Exactly. Well, once you know where you want to be, then you have to figure out how to get there.
You know what? The thing is, one key aspect that we just, you know, are flying kind of blind is that eventually we need to repay some of the debt that it's outstanding. So in the next couple of years, what is going to be key is what are going to be the scheduled payments on the debts. Since this works from the bottom up, once you set whatever the, you know, when you go and buy your house, at the very end of the transaction, the bank hands you an amortization schedule. And this is telling you, you know, how much is going to be your monthly payment, and this is how you're going to amortize your debt, and this is how you're going to be paying the interest. At some point, you know, at the end of the 30 years, you're going to owe zero, and then you eventually have the title of your house, okay? So in order to start that amortization schedule, we need to set what is going to be the interest rate. You know, it's going to be the new owed principal. So we can schedule those payments. Once we have that, then the rest of the equation in terms of the budget will work. Because first and foremost, you owe those investors that amount of money. Now, once you have that payment set, then the remainder of the money goes into whatever the government decides are the budget priorities. Since we don't have not even a minimal, we just don't know how much is going to be the result of the negotiations, having so many issuers, so many investors. I do not think we're going to be able to set up kind of where are we going for the next couple of 2.5, maybe 3 years, which, and of course, you know, lawyers and accountants are going to be earning a lot of money. But you know, it is what it is. We need the payment schedule on whatever, you know, is the result of Title III or Title V or VI, whatever title, you know, it's the debt renegotiation. It's a loss mitigation exercise. So that's going to take at least, that's my perspective, maybe 18 to 36 more months. So until then, we have kind of more degrees of freedom because we don't have to pay debt. But once the debt has been renegotiated, we really have to stick to the plan. And, you know, the social costs are still going to be there. And this is going to hurt every single one of, you know, the 3.6 million people in Puerto Rico.
And just to wrap it up again, if you were to grade the work of the Fiscal Oversight Board, what grade would you give it? Both of you.
You know, here's the deal. The political class have evidence that they have no clue whatsoever on how to address this issue. Fiscal board they wasted too much time in order to get, you know, their ball rolling. I think they're trying to get a hold of what are the real problems, but I don't think they're getting it right. So this is a matter of not to get a final grade. This is kind of midterm grades. Local government has an F. Fiscal board has a C+. And I think they're starting to figure it out that the local administrators have no clue what they're doing. But they have, the only thing is if the political class, local political class is the enemy, then the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And what it's, the downside is the fiscal board is the one that it's stopping some of the wrongdoing. And when they try to do stuff, they do their wrongdoing as well. So it's a double negative that it doesn't become a positive.
Okay, no, I think the fiscal board understands its mission as a very limited mission of basically straightening out Puerto Rico's finances. And I think that there was a need for a fiscal board. In fact, as far back as 2010, I remember I suggested as much, and I had a couple of legislators sitting in the front row of this place where I was giving this speech, and I'll never forget the expressions they had in their faces, because they assumed that it was, you know, they took it as an insult and so on. But the fact is that the local political class has taken the country to where it is. I mean, the famous book by Cemoglu and Richardson, where why nations fail, basically what they say is nations fail because their political systems fail. Well, our political system has failed miserably. And the board essentially became inevitable. You had to have a board. But I do wish that the board would be less mechanical in its approach to economics. And that would, I think, make a big difference. I've been very critical of the board because one of the things that the board's decisions is creating is basically one that they're destroying the institutional setup of the island, and the social costs that are involved in what they're doing is also huge.
I mean, the UPR, for example.
The UPR, sure, the retirement things. So I wish that they at least understood a little better what the social and economic situation of Puerto Rico was, which I don't think they do. I agree with Antonio on that. Basically because they're people who are very isolated from real life. I mean, essentially, you take the three local members, basically, one is a very wealthy person, very nice fellow, but certainly not in touch with realities. One has spent the last few years in New York as a president of a financial institution, and the other one has lived in California all her life. And they all come from very affluent families. There's nothing wrong with that. But what is wrong is, I think, that they just simply don't understand what the social realities in Puerto Rico are. And they keep bringing up the same sort of mechanical responses to the issues. Part of the reason, I think, is basically because their economic analysis is so flawed. And part of the reason why that happens is because they're at main advisor is somebody who comes from the International Monetary Fund, and they have their own recipes and their own prescriptions. And that leads them to make silly projections like eliminating Law 80 will generate 0.8% of growth, real growth in a year. Well, that's nonsense, I mean. And a number of other things. Their insistence on the earned income tax credit. Well, the earned income tax credit might make a lot of sense in the U.S., but it makes absolutely no sense in Puerto Rico. There's things like that. I really don't think they understand what the economy of Puerto Rico is all about. And I think that leads to the things that they're doing.
Thank you, gentlemen, for sharing your expertise with News Is My Business and for discussing such vital information for Puerto Rico. If you, our listeners, have a topic you would like to hear us discuss in this space, please send us an email to news@newsismybusiness.com with your suggestions. Until next time.